Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Real Time Crime. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Devi.
And for the month of December, we are going to be covering cases that are related to murders during the winter holidays. So for today's episode, we are covering the case of the Hulibert family. Take it away, Jedi.
So this story is taking place in Middletown, Pennsylvania, on the early night of Christmas Eve in 2002. Like I said, it's a Hulibert family. So Ernest is the husband or dad, Jean is the mother, and they have been married for about 20 years until their recent separation in the early summer of 2002. So together they had two daughters and one grandchild. The oldest daughter was Victoria, who was 20 years old at this time, and she had a daughter and her name was Madison, who at this time was 9 months old. They also had their second daughter, whose name was Elizabeth, but went by Izzy, and at this time was 15.
Okay, so we've got a mom and a dad, and they have two daughters, and then the oldest daughter has a daughter.
Yes. Before I get deep into the story, I do want to warn everyone that this story does have some aspects of sexual assault. So if that's something that upsets you or triggers you, this story may not be for you. But as always, stay tuned for our next episode. So in the early summer of 2002, Izzy and Victoria confessed to their aunt that their father had been sexually assaulting them for many, many years. It was actually Victoria, the one that brought it up, because she said it had been happening to her for many years. But when she found out it was also happening to Izzy, she decided to actually speak up and bring it up to their mother's attention. Victoria actually confessed that she never said anything because Ernest, their father, had promised that he wouldn't rape Izzy if Victoria never said anything.
So she let her father continue to assault her in order to protect her younger sister. And then she finds out that it didn't matter anyways.
Yes. That's awful. That's when she was like, you know what, why am I going to stay quiet? I am going to speak up anyways. Mind you, at this time, she's already 20 years old. So for it to be happening to her 15-year-old little sister, you know, it's very upsetting and I totally understand her.
Do we know how long it was happening to the younger sister?
I'm not sure. I couldn't find anything, but I do know that Victoria said it had happened to her since she was little. So I can only assume, you know, 10, 15 years. And probably the same for Izzy. Right. At this time, she's 15. So maybe also since she was a little girl.
It's awful.
So right away, they told their mother, Jean, and she took it straight to the authorities. She went to the police, you know, like a good mother. Yes, kudos to her. And right away he was arrested and charged with sexual assault charges, and he was ordered to move away from the home. So sort of like a protection order. He wasn't allowed to live in the home, not even come near the block, not even see them like outside of the home, nothing. So he moved to his parents' house in Cambria County, Pennsylvania, which is about 2.5 hours away. Unfortunately, he was released in July of 2002 on a $100,000 bail pending trial, which was scheduled for January 2003.
Did you find out who paid that bail? Was it his parents?
No, I'm assuming his parents. Yeah, I'm assuming his parents, but I couldn't find anything concrete. So fast forward to, you know, Christmas Eve, the Hulibert family had a tradition where they would go over Jean's parents, so the in-laws, for Christmas dinner. So Christmas Eve dinner. And this tradition had been going on for many, many years. It sounded like ever since the Hulibers were married. So they would go over Jean's parents' house for dinner, stay over, spend the night, and then the next morning they would open the Christmas presents with the kids. So this year was a little bit different because, like I said, they had separated. Ernest was back with his parents and the whole sexual assault thing. They didn't feel comfortable with having Ernest sleep over. However, he did go over for dinner. So Christmas Eve came and Jean's parents were kind of worried because it was already past dinner time and they were still not at their house. And it was very unusual for them to be late for Christmas dinner. they did give them some like benefit of doubt because it, you know, it's 2.5 hours away. You're driving this much distance in the winter. So anything can really happen, you know, a snowstorm, whatever. So Jean's parents decided to wait a little bit longer. They called the Hulaver's family's home, no answer. So then eventually the parents got pretty upset and worried, as, you know, any parent, and they decided to call the state police. They just wanted to know if there had been like an accident on their way to their home. You know, worst case scenario, they got into an accident and they couldn't call them, whatever. No accident. So then they decide to call Middletown's police department, which is like their hometown, just to do a welfare check, because it was very, like I said, it was very unusual for them to be this late. And like worst case, they were late. They could have called before. So I'm not sure if they had cell phones at this time. It's 2002.
They had cell phones, but they weren't great. So yeah. Like, I don't know about you, but like, I didn't get my first cell phone until I was 14. So that's a decade before.
Yeah.
I was 14. So.
Yeah. So, you know, worst case scenario, they were late. They could have called from their landline, like their home phone.
Or
like,
hey,
we're running late. Right.
They still had those then.
Yeah, true. So like, hey, we're running late, but we'll be there in like an hour, whatever. Right. But that never happened. So when they call the Middletown police department, as always, which really annoys me, but they said, you know what, wait till the next morning and then we'll go do a welfare check. Annoying. So then they do actually call the next morning, because unfortunately the Hulaver family never shows up for Christmas Eve dinner. So Jean's mother calls again next morning and says, hey, you know, they never showed up for dinner. Can you do a welfare check now? So they do. The police officer shows up, knocks on the door, rings the doorbell, no one answers. So then he decides to go to the back of the house. So when I was reading, it sounds like their garage was connected to their home. So he goes to the back door and he knocks, no answer. But then he sees that the garage door is like unlatched. So he opens it, calls out, you know, when like police presents themselves, no answer, continues to walk in the home. Then the door that connected to the house was open as well. So he unlatches it, walks to the door. So when he walks into the house, he, you know, announces himself again, no answer, but he hears some noise like in the upstairs room. So he's like entering the home, walking through the home, and he walks into the kitchen when he sees the first body laying on the floor, on the kitchen floor. And this body was the mom's. So it was Jean's body. Right away, he sees her. There's no sign of life because she's cold to the touch, meaning that she had been dead for a couple hours. And right away, he also notices that she has a gunshot wound straight to the head, just a single gunshot wound. So he continues to walk to the house. He goes upstairs. In one of the bedrooms, he finds Victoria, who is the oldest daughter, and also finds her deceased with a gunshot wound to the front of her, so like her forehead. But unfortunately, so trigger warning, the baby was still wrapped in her arms. So mind you, she's like laying in a pool of blood and her baby's in her arms. Luckily, the baby was not harmed, but you know, this was like 2 days later, so she was severely dehydrated. So right away, they take the baby, they take her to the ambulance, and she's fine, just dehydrated. Then they find the third body still upstairs, which is the youngest daughter, Izzy. And they were all shot to death, literally just a single gunshot, which killed them all. So, you know, obviously this is a murder. It's not like a suicide or whatever. It's clear that it's a murder. I also want to point out that the police officer found the back door, like it had been broken into, and one of the back windows was literally like broken. So he could only assume that it was a break-in at this point. So the first suspect that, well, not suspect, but the first person that they talk to is obviously Ernest, because he's the father. So they take the trip to Cambria County, which, like I said, is about 2.5 hours away. And when they get there and talk to him, he has an alibi, or an alleged alibi, for the night of the 24th. So this happened like the very early hours of the 24th, between like 2 a.m. and like 6 a.m. So, like I said, they go question him. He has an alleged alibi that he was out hunting with his brother Scott, and the time frame that he gives the police is 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. when he was, you know, hunting. So it's allegedly confirmed because they also talked to the brother Scott Hulover, and he says same thing. We were out hunting and, you know, whatever, coyote watching from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. whatever. So they clear them because they checked their alibi. The second person that they, or third person that they talk to is Frankie Ramos, who is the father of Victoria's baby. This was because they had like a very on and off relationship. They kind of had a bad relationship. Frankie refused to like accept paternity until they went to court, yada, yada. So he was just like a person that they had to look into. But same thing, like he had an alibi and he was cleared a couple hours later. So after they spoke to Turner, the police actually requested search warrants because they went back to looking into the family. So directly like Scott and Ernest, they were able to get search warrants for the vehicle for Scott and Ernest. And I think they found something like very leading in their car that literally led to the whole investigation. When they're searching their cars in the trunk of Scott's car, they find a note that says, quote, "We were out spotting deer and coyotes," quote. Literally just in a random piece of paper. So when I read this, the first thing that came to my mind is like when you're in school, like writing notes to each other. And like if you get caught with something and you're like writing a note, like, hey, say this. So in my head, I'm thinking like, what if Ernest gave this note to Scott and like said, hey, say this, you know?
That's exactly what I was thinking. They were like getting their story straight.
Yeah. So after they, obviously this is very sketchy, like a random note of what they actually said was their alibi. So the two brothers are brought back in for questioning, and Ernest actually says that he wants to remain silent and right away contacted his attorney. And Scott literally just word by word kept saying his same like rehearsed alibi. Like, no, we were out hunting. We were out coyote watching from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. Literally just the same thing. And in the sources that I read, like they even said it sounded rehearsed. So then after, you know, they're kept there for a long time, the detectives and investigators bring out the crime scene pictures and show them to Scott and Ernest. At this point, Ernest is not budging. He's like, no, my attorney will talk to you guys, whatever. Scott, however, breaks down after he sees the crime scene photos because, you know, it's his sister-in-law and his nieces and his great niece that are, you know, clear crime scene of them deceased.
Yeah, very violently deceased. And so clearly we understand who was not involved.
Yeah. So this is where we get kind of like the big break. After he sees the pictures, he just breaks down and starts telling the police everything he knows. So he says that on the night of the, well, like late night of the 23rd, going into early morning of the 24th, he says that Ernest calls him and tells him that he has to drive to Middletown, like his old home where Jean and his daughters were, to pick up his dog, quote unquote, pick up his dog. Scott actually said that earlier that night they were drinking, and that's when he said, you know, like, hey, let me go pick up my dog. So first of all, they shouldn't be driving this far, 2.5 hours, if they were drinking. But anywho, so Scott drives Ernest to Middletown, 2.5 hours away. And he says that he dropped him off close to like 4 a.m. So Scott says that Ernest requested that he drops him off a block away from their Middletown home, which is very weird. But he was like, you know, stay right here. I'll go in and out the house and I'll be right back. So he does. And Ernest walks away, goes into the house. And Scott says that he comes back not even 10 minutes later. But when he comes back, it's very obvious that he's like very agitated and just not himself. So after they leave the home, like I said, he was very agitated, but Scott asked him like, what's wrong? What's going on? And he just wouldn't say anything. So then when they go back, they stop like in some wood area, and Ernest leaves the car and like goes to dig the pistol and the shotgun, and just comes back like nothing happened. And he still refuses to tell Scott like what actually happened. So then after Scott tells the police that he had dug, you know, the shotgun and the weapons, they go back to the area to look for the weapons. And they find the pistol because of the, it was very weird. They saw like some rust, which like stood out because of the color. And that's the only reason they could find it. They go back, run the serial number. Turns out this gun was Ernest's mother's brother. So Ernest's uncle's gun. After they do like the ballistic testing, it shows that indeed this was a murder weapon. So at this point, it's clear from Scott's testimony, from the ballistic testing and whatnot, that Ernest Hulover killed his wife or ex-wife and his two daughters. So fast forward to the trial. He is charged with 3 counts of first degree murder, and the state was asking for the death penalty. Scott, unfortunately, was also charged as an accomplice and was held without bail. This kind of made me sad because he literally had no clue what was going on until this moment where he's confessing and like puts 2 and 2 together. So he actually agreed to a plea deal, and he pled guilty to the 3 counts of third degree murder and was given a sentence of 12 to 25 years before he became eligible for parole. Very unfortunate. So get this, while Ernest is in jail waiting for his trial, he tries to hire a hitman who is another prisoner. Yeah, he's just digging his hole deeper.
He's hiring a hitman, and the hitman is a prisoner with him.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Like in the jail. And this man's name was James Meddings. So Ernest hires this hitman, or attempts to hire this hitman, because he wants to kill Frankie. So the baby's father, he wants to kill Frankie and wants it to look like a suicide. With this plan is that Frankie will allegedly leave a suicide note confessing that he killed Jean Victoria Izzy. Thankfully, this man actually reports it to the authorities, and thankfully only adds one more count to, you know, Ernest's trial. So after this happens, they hire a DEA agent within the jail to sort of like bribe Ernest and finally get some like evidence that he's trying to hire a hitman. And it worked because he tried to also get this DEA agent to be a hitman. After they gather the evidence from the DEA agent is when they add the other counts of criminal solicitation.
So he tried to hire a hitman who's a prisoner, and the prisoner turns him in and he gets in trouble. Mm-hmm. And then he tries to hire a planted DEA agent, uh-huh, so another prisoner.
Yeah, it works.
Two. This guy is really smart.
Yeah. Yep. So at this point, Ernest is convicted on 3 counts of first degree murder, killing a prosecution witness, conspiracy, reckless endangerment of the baby, burglary, and criminal solicitation. He was sentenced with 3 sentences. So eventually he tried appealing. So he was also running the sexual assaults offenses. And I do want to mention that many people said that they thought he killed the family, because if you really think about it, his sexual assault trial was scheduled for January of 2003, literally 2 weeks after these murders. So a lot of people, and I honestly agree, a lot of people said that he did it to avoid his trial, which only made it worse. Like, how are you digging your hole deeper with, oh, let me dodge a sexual assault trial, but let me kill my family?
He really thinks he can get away with stuff. He sexually assaults his kids and then thinks that he can get away with it by killing them. And then he thinks he can beat the murder charges by hiring a hitman.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the end just gets charged for all of it, as he rightfully should. Okay, mm-hmm, cool.
So fast forward to 2014. Unfortunately, his sexual abuse charges were acquitted. Because the reason being that his witnesses were deceased, that he murdered.
They didn't consider the fact that he had been charged for their murders as the reason as to why they couldn't be there to testify. That's so
this, this article says the Superior Court noted that the sexual abuse charges are inextricably tied to the murders, and Hulover is not entitled to relief that would expunge his record. So they knew that they were tied. However, I think because the witnesses were dead, like they couldn't directly charge him. I mean, he still got three death sentences for his the murders. But
yeah, I guess that's fair. It just seems. Yeah, it's fair.
Yeah, no, but I get what you're saying. Like, they couldn't testify because they were murdered by him. Like, yeah. So the latest update that I was able to find was in 2019. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court upheld Hulover's convictions, dismissing over a dozen issues that he raised on an appeal. And Ernest was, like, seeking an appeal or relief because he said that having all these charges would hinder him, his chances of proving himself innocent in the long run. So for some crazy reason, they took away or dismissed 12 issues. So who knows? He's still in jail, but because he exhausted his state appeals, it now has to go through like the federal appeal process. So who knows? Maybe he will keep appealing it at the federal level, but so far he is still in jail. I don't know how you can appeal three death sentences.
Right. So all he's doing is continuing to make these appeals in order to stall the fact that he still has three death sentences because he still is holding those charges.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the only ones they could really take away are the one they already did, burglary, maybe the reckless endangerment of the baby because she was fine. Maybe conspiracy, maybe criminal solicitation, but you know, the ones that they are not going to take away are first degree murder, which is essentially why he's getting the death sentences. So a man can dream.
Do you know how old he is?
He was 43 at the time, and this was in 2002.
He's like
63. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's still pretty young. He can still. I don't know. Not like he's going to make it out. So we always like to end our episodes with some sort of takeaway, but I think this story or episode is just a very like unfortunate family case.
Yeah, I think the family did everything right. I think, you know, the older sister was just trying to protect the younger sister. As soon as it all came out, the mom was in action. They, you know, they separated, they got the kids out of the situation. I don't know how you could have prevented this.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't even, like, I don't agree that he was invited to the dinner, but they didn't even make it to the dinner. It was the day before the dinner.
Yeah. So it was just very unfortunate overall. But nonetheless, I hope everyone gets into the holiday spirit, whatever it is that you celebrate. We want to wish you all happy holidays. And we will for sure have another episode before Christmas for those that do celebrate Christmas.
Our next case will be coming out on the 16th of December, the week before Christmas.
Yes. And luckily, December has three Thursdays, so we will get three episodes this month.
Before we go, we do have some exciting news. We've been working on making a website and a TikTok. So we will post both. We've been posting the TikTok links on our Instagram, and we will begin to post our website and the TikTok links on all of our social medias.
So now that we have TikTok, I think it'll be a perfect platform for us to do like mini updates on cases we've already covered, like the Jelani Day case, the Gabby Petito case, as well as, you know, if we see a cool story, a short story that we want to cover on our TikTok. So yeah, just keep an eye out on our social media as always for updates on those. And you can follow us on TikTok and our website. Once again, thank you all so much for listening, and we will be back on December 16th with our next episode.